Hello, boils and ghouls and non-dinary people. Welcome to From the Rooftops, October Spooktacular, Part 1. That was Clay. This is Talon, and we're here to talk to you about, this time, the science monster.
Yes, yes. Long have we slaved over this production. Long have they laughed at our achievements, but now you'll all see!
Yes! So, the term science monster is, as with everything else I've ever used when academically discussing comic books and the superhero genre, a concept I stole from Clay. It's true!
It'll only be bad if you get rich off it. Then I'll come for you. For now, it's just bullshit.
Dude, if I get rich off this, I'm hiring you as a consultant.
Oh, man.
It'll be a very small business with, like, you know, actual creative work division, Clay, and dealing with white person bullshit, Talon.
I want one of those in my day-to-day life, man.
Yeah. I cannot imagine that the Starbucks menu was created for any purpose but to weed out the people who have no time for that. It's like, oh, I'm sorry, I can't be looking at your menu for this long to work out what exactly I want to drink. I have a job. Give me a coffee. All right, so the science monster is a concept that Clay used once to describe the way that, as with our episode on mutants with metaphor, certain types of characters in superhero stories represented a generalized anxiety or fear of a particular thing. In this case, something to do with the general current view of science.
Yeah, like the Hulk, obviously. Godzilla, even more obviously. Ultron, any robot gone mad. Any mad scientist's creation. And this goes, of course, all the way back to Frankenstein and or his monster.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, if you want to go deep into the tank on this, you can draw a very direct lineage from the first science fiction pulp novel, Frankenstein, all the way through to comic books, where this has just formed the bedrock of so many different storytelling structures. One of the best examples, I feel, in comic books of like a condensed Reader's Digest right. version of the idea is the entire Spider-Man oeuvre. Because if you think about Spider-Man and all of Spider-Man's most important villains, they are all in some way science monsters. Just low-key science monsters.
Right, and that's the thing, too. You don't have to be actually physically monstrous, necessarily, so much as you have to have, a monstrous relationship with society, maybe? Is
it
good?
The scientific element of your character has to be alienating. Mm-hmm. So the Hulk's rage being incarnated as an inability to operate in a normal societal level is one thing, but on the other hand, the Vulture's general disdain for most people he sees and deals with because he knows more than they do is still the same thing.
It's interesting, too, because it's interesting that Vulture is one of those characters who's so locked down into being a crusty old man, despite, you know, being a technological genius and whatnot, and I guess that's kind of the Rick and Morty of it, the asshole scientist thing. And when people have tried to make younger Vultures, it just doesn't feel as good as when he's just an angry, pissed off old man.
Yeah. And part of the reason Science Monster works for this is that it doesn't even require you to be yourself scientific. Consider Sandman.
Yeah. That's the thing when we talk about science versus tech. We say there's a difference between being a person who is science and a person who does science, right? And for me, a lot of science monsters are science, less so than do science.
Tony Stark is not, has very little overlap at all with a science monster. In part because what he does is stuff that he can pick up and put down, even though he's got the core reactor in his chest preserving his heart. He's still a person who's interacting with objects. For the most part, science monsters don't have that luxury. And if you look at the rundown of the Spider-Man gallery, you have Doc Ock, who is both a mad scientist and the mad scientist's creation. You have the symbiote and Venom and Carnage and all that, and that connected swing of stuff. And they're all aliens from beyond the stars that we can't communicate with meaningfully. You have the Green Goblin, who is a industrialist dealing with mental issues. In that case, the science element of the character is the science of psychology.
I know
he's not the strongest.
He did that to himself, with science, you know?
Yeah, with science. And then you even have, especially now, this new version of the Vulture, where the Vulture's thing, it used to be he made a flying suit, but now the newer iterations of the Vulture tend towards the scientific democratization of technology means that a working class guy who's been screwed over can now take to that level of super tech individually. And that distances him from society because he realizes that it's just a matter of his will that takes him there. So, and of course, Spider-Man himself, who has, through, I think, 4 major iterations now, shown different relationships to different types of science.
Right. I always enjoy, again, just the range of science monsters that are so completely separate and are still heroic in that way, like the original incarnations of Swamp Thing and the Hulk, for example. Because, you know...
Yeah.
Part of the thing of having these characters be your hero is that, you know, to go step outside the typical superhero spectrum, instead of just, you know, a guy in a costume with cool gadgets or weapons, it's, you know, this person whose whole life is kind of sad and who is obviously monstrous in that way.
Yeah. Like, to use a counterpoint on that, Luke Cage definitely taps into the anxiety about science, especially the versions of him where it was experiments based on a prison experiment. But Luke Cage isn't a science monster.
Nah.
His powers do not separate him from his world. They do not mean that he is now monstrous to the people around him.
Oh, and if you write Superman that way, you're bad.
Yeah, yeah. Superman... Look, if you want to write a Superman who has anxieties about connections to science and power, go write for the Authority. It's right there. No one's using it for anything good.
Hey, dude, instead of a Superman, try something else. A Superboy, a Connor Kent, a clone with all that anxiety. You even get the S. You're very happy.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's not like he... And Connor is a very good example of the hot science monster.
Right.
Tapping into fears of cloning, issues of identity, issues of what if a child just appeared in my life and was talking about, yeah, we're related, by the way. I'm your responsibility now, by the way. And there's a whole raft load of stuff there with Connor Kent. And he's still hot, so you're not locked into going with ugly if you go science monster. So you should at least give it a try.
That's the thing about these figures, because they're supposed to be sort of represent or like encapsulate a big threat, a big problem, a thing you have to worry about, which is why you don't see many I can't even think of any, maybe Martian Manhunter, who are like iconic major name superheroes who are an important part of their society. Like, and he gets to change, you know, he gets to change shape. He gets to get out of that when he wants to.
Yeah, I don't consider the Martian Manhunter to be a science monster. He plays much more into tropes of the outsider, and he has narratively, for the types of stories you can tell about him, the Martian Manhunter has a lot more in common with, say, Red Tornado than he has in common with the Hulk.
Now, we put that against the white Martians, like Miss Martian, and the whole thing of their quote-unquote inherent violence, and they play the angle of the alien invader more than Martian Manhunter ever did, right? Like, the closest he ever came to that was the one moment when he first appeared, and him just being a Martian gave a guy a heart attack because he was worried about alien invaders, so he died. Everyone else, you don't really deal with that with him so much, but with Miss Martian, you get a lot of that because of the whole white Martian, green Martian angle. That was me.
Yeah, well, that's kind of the fundamentals of what the science monster is. The science monster doesn't have to be a protagonist. It does have to have some contemporary view of science and it needs to be actually grounded in what we do understand of science, which means that often these characters wind up being dated very quickly. And this is why I bring up Spider-Man, because Spider-Man's very first spider that bit him, I want to say the earliest versions, it was just a really weird spider, and the fear was exploration.
No, it was... I have those, but unless you're talking about creation, like just in Stan's head, or Jack's head, or whoever, no, Steve's head, whoever, but...
Possibly.
But I actually have, you know, reprints of the originals, and it was still, he went to the radiation...
Yeah, that's right.
...demonstration.
The first spider was radioactive.
Right.
Because it had been experimented on, and this is, you know, rise of the Cold War, nuclear tensions, the nuclear power was the thing that everyone was scared of. And the mutating power of the atom and whatnot. And then I think it's around the 90s that story was retold to instead be about a genetically tampered spider.
I think the weird thing about how we walk away from those fears is that sometimes the danger didn't go away. Nuclear weapons are still a problem. In fact, you know, we're kind of concerned about who's going to be bumming who in the next couple of months right now. So, did that fear go away?
Yeah.
Or just go out of style? Which is, it's that indication of people's short attention spans, right? I guess they're like, well, hey, we haven't seen any nuclear mutants yet, and we haven't blown anything up yet, so I guess it's not that scary. Like, it's still there, dude. There's radioactive crocodiles and Chernobyl and shit, but whatever. Tell them about the radioactive crocodiles, by the way, Talon.
Real quick excursion into real world science here. For anyone who's not aware, the crocodile is one of the scariest goddamn things on Earth. Period. All right. Part of what makes them so they are as an evolutionary pattern, they have existed pretty much unchanged for millions of years. They have existed for more or less the same pattern a very long time, and they've survived all sorts of natural disasters and extinction events and everything, and just kept going, which means that everything in their system tends to be very, very good at keeping them alive. In the case of crocodiles, this means that their immune system just goes through the roof. Diseases in crocodiles very rarely get sick. If an antibody gets into a crocodile's bloodstream, it gets shredded too quickly for it to have an effect. So we're trying to use crocodile blood for antibiotics, and it's so good at what it does that it winds up destroying other blood when we introduce it. It's really scary stuff. This means that almost anything we've thrown at them, they've been fine with. There are two places in the world now where, thanks to humans not being very smart with nuclear technology, toxic waste or radioactive material has gotten into the water table and become part of the breeding cycle of crocodiles. In northern Queensland and in South Carolina, there are crocodiles that are radioactive. No one's testing this yet, but it appears to be a serious enough component of their actual, like, living biology that if this crocodile bites you, in addition to the fact that you've just been bitten by a crocodile, you probably have lymphoma. Yeah. Because that's what they really needed to give them that
edge. What you're saying is, if you're in the wild, in that part of the country, and a crocodile bites you, just lay down. Because even if you get away, you're fucked. Actually, that's kind of like Komodo dragons and their whole thing, where they bite you and you just attract a horrible virus, and then they just follow the smell of you rotting.
Yeah. I love Komodo dragons. They're one of the very few reptilian endurance predators that exist. Humans are an endurance predator too, where we'll hit a thing and then we'll just follow it until it dies, which scares the hell out of animals, by the way. And this is the thing. This is best understanding of real-world science as we can apply it, and this means that if I was to then go on and write a story about Killer Croc gets exposed to radiation, and it doesn't give him superpowers, but it does mean now he can give you cancer.
You know, I mean, I don't know, I guess Killer Croc counts because the whole thing is supposed to be, I guess, the representation of genetic atavism, as they call it, which isn't even a real fucking thing, but whatever. Just the idea of...
Look, I'm just going to do a real quick check here on when Killer Croc first got published, because I have a nagging feeling I know what inspired Killer Croc. Okay, so 1983. How about that? Around the point they banned thalidomide.
The things that's the thing, right? Oh god. So like, what this timetable we're creating means in what, 2 or 3 years? There's someone with like someone in the business right now is workshopping the idea for like some kind of vaccine autism baby or something villain.
Oh, that's almost certainly been made already. You've got to remember, those people work fast because they don't have to have quality.
This is a bad quality idea I'm presenting to you.
It's like, what was Steve Ditko's objectivist quote-unquote hero? The black and white
Mr.
guy?
Mr. A, and also the question first was created.
Yeah.
He made like five versions of
Mr. A. Yeah, Mr. A, his comics, they didn't come out quickly because they were written like books. But, yeah, you don't need a lot of time to make a propaganda comic. It actually happens reasonably quickly. Now, the science monster plays in heavily to a lot of the creepy Christian comics I read as a kid, by the way. Because they were written by people who not only didn't understand science, but were actively trying to demonize science to people who also didn't know about science. So you'd get villains whose whole thing was like, well, evolution proves there is no God, so I can do whatever I want, so I will take over the world. It's like, that's not even vaguely how that works.
It's weird how that shit creeps in. Well, creeps in. It's weird how those exact same people turn around and do the same shit, you know, in major areas, you know, in bigger, that's the whole Overton window thing, right? They come up with their dumb bullshit and, you know, we both sides them into an important role in society.
Yeah.
But I think what, Hulk is currently some version of chemical testing and genetic engineering? I don't think so. I think it's still quote-unquote gamma radiation. And that may be one of the benefits of making up your own radiation, making up your own fake science based on loosely real science. I don't think any versions of Fantastic Four ever weren't tied to cosmic radiation. It tends to vary where that radiation comes from, but it's still quote-unquote... Well, no, actually, memory serves. Ultimate Fantastic Four dealt with a dimensional travel situation, and that's what they did with that last movie that they then, I think. I don't know. Maybe? Did you see that movie?
I didn't, but I'm not alone in not seeing that movie.
I think it was a dimensional thing. Like, they traveled to Gen X or...
I remember this now. And this is the one where they turn Dr. Doom into, like, a T-800 Terminator with psychic powers, because... Sure, why not?
Well, you know, it's...
This is fantastic, yeah.
Dr. Doom's got a lot of shit going on, and I guess they felt like it would take too long to get... It would be too much to put all that shit in, you know? Like, you'd have to go for the magic, you'd have to go to the science, then you'd have to go to fucking Shambhala or some shit to get the fucking armor.
Yeah. Now, in some ways, the advancement of science actually improves certain characters as we revise them based on the science we know. Particularly... Let me see if you remember this comic panel. With your genetic tampering abilities, you could be curing cancer. I don't want to cure cancer. I want to make dinosaurs.
I'm trying to think. Is that Stegoron or Sauron? I think it's Sauron.
I think that's Sauron.
Because Sauron's a mutant. He's a mutant who also technically turns into a... Sauron is a vampire, like energy vampire, who steals your energy. And he does this while in the form of Pterodactyl Man. But it's like a Stegoron thing. Stegoron is a...
Yeah, it's Sauron.
Is a Spider-Man villain. He's like a... He's the lizard, but dinosaur-y. And he turns people into dinosaurs. And the lizard is actually one of my favorite Spider-Man villains.
Yeah.
I kind of hate when they do, like... I don't like supervillain, like, lizard, where he's smart and he tries to turn everyone else into lizard. Because I like him as, like, the Hulk of Spider-Man. You know? Just like that one.
Yeah. So where... Now, just because, again, we know more about... we generally know more about superheroes than you do, and we're right. But in the context of the lizard specifically, if the lizard is a unchangeable, inhuman monster creature who is also a super scientist who wants to force the world to reflect his image, he's Doc Ock 2.0. And you lose everything that the lizard brings to that equation.
Right, the monstrousness, the whole primal mind thing, the whole aspect of, you know, how sad it is for Kurt Connors to be the way he is, because it's not even that he wanted power. He just wanted his fucking arm back. That's completely fair.
Yeah.
That's nothing. He didn't want to make a weapon. He didn't even want to make something to make him rich. He was just like, look at this. I can't fucking do it. I want my arm, man. And it just all went bad for him.
That was my jack-off hand.
I was I was trying not to. I'm glad you did, because I was trying not to.
So this is part of the quandary of that particular type of character, in that, especially when you're going like, well, let's be careful about science. The science that we are usually being scared of, usually, not always, is stuff that's being actively pursued to make people's lives better. Like, I know some people who are missing limbs, and I imagine if I approached them and said, look, we can give you full mobility back, but you might look like a totally rad lizard. It's not, like, to everyone who hasn't had to live with any kind of disability or physical hindrance, the reaction is, oh no, he may have gotten his arm back, but at what cost? And you know, oh no, Doc Ock may have these cool cyborg limbs that give him enormous amount of power and success, but what has it done to who he truly is? And that's almost always this very conservative mindset of anti-science, saying, no, no, don't try and improve your life or repair damage or help people, because, oh, if we start curing people of cancer, who knows where that might land up?
Oh, man, there'd be so many industries out of work. Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, won't someone spare a thought for the wheelchair manufacturers?
But on the flip side of that is, like, just raw, unethical, like, experimentation and people who are caused. Obviously, on the one hand, we have just science used to make weapons, and then on the other hand, we just have people doing science to others for the sake of wanting to do their own shit. You know, like the High Evolutionary or Die Shocker or, that's one of the older, more like, sort of, I guess, pathosy things about, like, Ishinomori stuff with, you know, Kamen Rider and Cyborg 009, where, like, the first Kamen Rider, he had this problem where he looked normal most of the time, but he had all this cyborg shit in him, and so he would just crush things whenever he tried to touch them. And it was unfortunately, that's a thing they kind of weaned away from him over time, where they just said, well, I guess he got control over. But some of the earliest episodes were just him, like, trying not to crush puppies with his own hands, and how terrible that was. Or you get, you know... Mm-hmm.
But in all seriousness, I pulled up the Spider-Man list of enemies to just double-check if there was anyone I was missing. And there is one pair of characters in this list whose bio does not include the phrase, laboratory accident.
I'm sure one of them is Shocker, and the other one would be...
Black Cat.
I think she's currently villainous at this moment, so I'll give it that.
And I mean, you can look at Kingpin as well, but
yeah. Well, again, he's become more of a Daredevil street level villain, and at the very least, he's a villain for the Marvel Universe in general.
Yeah, but there is the other problem of, like, Spider-Man's whole ideology is in a single phrase that we have heard over and over and over again, right? And the source of his great power is science. And it is something that separates him from his life and keeps him from being completely connected to the people around him, because he has that great power. And Spider-Man's villains gallery is almost universally people who have been given great power by science and refuse to engage with it responsibly. So many of these people are just fucking goons. So many of them are just random goons who got superpowers from a lab accident.
Well, you know, there's a certain element of, like, I guess, you know, you're who's worthy of power and who deserves to have it. And you very rarely see these stories of, like, a rich politician or someone in a position of power have this happen to them. And then, you know, they do the same thing because I was a dick beforehand. Actually, there was a Power Girl story that had a villain like this. He was just a guy who had money and was, like, investing in some big science thing. And he got exposed to something from Atlee's Earth Kingdom that turned him into some weird monster dude. And he was like, oh shit, no, now we're just going to do a bunch of fucking evil. Because, I mean, I was always like this, but now I can't be killed.
yeah. And that's one of the things with, I think, that Sam Raimi's depiction of Doc Ock, I really like that, in that, in his case, the suit, the like, he starts out as a bit of a prig, but not a bad person. And the Ock rig has a neuro rig that connects itself to his brain. And something goes wrong in that due to an accident. And suddenly the the rig starts controlling him and promoting the idea of promoting the rig is itself survival. And that's really an interesting take on Doc Ock, because if you look back at a lot of Doc Ock's early incarnations, he's kind of a really stupid scientist.
In terms of, like, life decisions, yeah. Like, the things, the choices he makes are very, just to be a supervillain, you know?
Yeah.
There was, that's why I love, again, I just love Spectacular Spider-Man in general, but I really love their version of Doc Ock, who was, one, pretty, like, competent in what he does, but also what they show is Doc Ock, and throughout the early stages of the show, right, he works for a mysterious, like, entity who is essentially creating supervillains for experimental purposes. They make Rhino, they make Sandman, they make Electro. Well, no, they don't make Electro. They don't make all of the villains, but they make enough. But also, their part, turns out he works for Osborn. Spoilers, everybody. And Osborn is a dick, and he treats him like shit. And so, every once in a while, you see these flashes of Doc Ock just trying to horribly murder Osborn, and then it flashes back, and he's just sitting there. He was just visualizing all the things he wanted to do. And once he got the power of the octopus arms, he says, well, fuck! And he goes off and becomes a villain. Like, he's been wanting to be that person for so long, and he couldn't, you know? And there was actually a terrible moment when it happens where, you know, he spends the whole thing just like, yes, Mr. Osborn, fine, Mr. Osborn, I'll be good, Mr. Osborn. And someone comes along and, like, traps him in the, you know, situation that'll turn him into Dr. Octopus. And the last thing he says was, but I was good! I was good, and they blah, and now they're fused to him, and he was so good, and yet he becomes this horrible asshole. You know, that's part of, like, you were so good, right? But you did these terrible experiments to people over the course of, like, a year, but you were good, right? Because you didn't argue, because you didn't fight, and you did morally reprehensible thing. So, were you good? Really, sir? Like, just because you didn't break any laws on paper, you know? Just because, you know, no one punished you for your crimes. It's because an evil person who controls you said, good job, were you good, right? And that's part of how, I guess, like, I don't see this enough, or maybe I'm not paying enough attention to the Hulk to know this, but I feel like that's where, like, a lot of the military's animus towards him come from, because he represents that they weren't good, right? Like, we did this horrible experiment, you know, testing bombs on, you know, in our country, and now there's this big walking you fucked up dude, you know, sign, smashing up things. Like, I wonder how much the system cares about the collateral damage he causes so much as how much he makes them look bad, right?
Yeah.
And there's elements of that with characters like the original, like the Captain America from Captain America Truth, Red, White, and Black, where the whole thing was sort of a parallel to the Tuskegee experiments, and they show this whole, like, platoon of Project Rebirth soldiers, all black men, who have just been turned into these, like, really horrible steroid dudes. Like, their heads are all misshapen, and they're big and strong. Maybe one of them comes out okay, and the rest of them, they can move around, and they can fight, but they're fucked up real bad. And, of course, their minds are broken, and they're dangerous. And a lot of it is just of this secret that the military wanted to keep so that people didn't know. They want to point to Captain America. They don't want to point to Josiah X, you know, in his wheelchair. No, not Josiah X. Isaiah Bradley, who was just, he's gone. You know, he's an old boxer in a super soldier body in a wheelchair. And that's one of those secrets. It's just because, like, you know, certain writers, you know, like, all the black characters in Marvel know about Isaiah Bradley. He, like, shows up to Black Panther's wedding one time, you know, when he gets married to Storm. They're like, yo, is that, yeah, it is. Hey, how are you? It's an honor to meet you. And he's just like,
nice. But yeah. The thing is, essentially, this is another way in which comics, as a kind of a long-form storytelling medium, get to tap into a, and look, forgive me for busting out this kind of language, a cultural zeitgeist. The fears of our grandparents were reflected in Spider-Man and in Superman and in, like, the Donner Superman movies, same thing. And then we retold them, and we retold them again, and we retold them again, and they reflect now upon what we're afraid of now, and who owns those characters, and who gets to tell those stories. This is part of why, by the way, Man of Steel is such a worthless piece of shit movie, right? Because the people making that, one of the things they're afraid of, even if they don't want to admit it, is the idea that they, powerful white men, will not constantly be okay enough to be in power.
Okay, let's go with that. No, yeah. let's go.
The morality outlined in Man of Steel is the morality of the Christian replacement media of my childhood. It's where you get this very Christological, I will endure the indignity of suffering and I can exert my will only on objects. Hurting people is only ever done in a direct physical confrontation. I know I've ranted about this on my blog, and if you don't stop me, I'm going to do it here.
That's right.
There's a sequence in Man of Steel where Clark is in a bar, working that bar, and a drunk grabs the waitress's butt, and Clark comes over and doesn't say anything. He just comes over with this sort of, like, threatening imposition of presence. And the drunk throws a beer at him and makes fun of him and then leaves. Sorry, and then Clark leaves. Like, that's it. Clark just takes the abuse and then walks off. And then you cut to the outside of the place, and that trucker's truck has been pulled apart and made into, like, a fucking craft project full with, like, you know, sticks of, telegraph poles.
He crucifies
the truck. Yeah, he crucifies the truck. And that's treated with a comedic beat, a sort of womp womp kind of moment. And of course, that's not seen as Clark ruining a man's life, destroying his health insurance access, or any of that stuff. It's just seen as like, well, that's kind of funny. He did a thing you didn't think he could do, and the truck's been destroyed, and no one heard it or saw it happen. So effectively, an act of God has just come out of nowhere and fucked up your life. Because the drunk prior to this point was a small guy picking a fight with someone who looks like Henry Cavill. I don't know how many of you out there have started a fight, but if you start a fight with someone significantly bigger than you, it's usually not because you're expecting to win. It's often because you have no alternative, or you don't mind the consequences of possibly getting a beating. Now, we can rule out the fact that the drunk was opposing Clark because of some greater reason. The drunk was probably just a dick. But that drunk was effectively signing up when he started abusing Clark for getting his face punched, maybe. He was probably okay with getting a beating. And instead, Clark, Christ-like, as the good white Republican Jesus, took the abuse nobly, then left the bar and quit his job. Side note. Do you think that bar hired a guy who was built like that so when a fight was about to break out, he could stand by and do fuck all? do you not know why people get hired to work in bars?
I like this.
It's a roadside truck bar, and they hire a man who looks like a bear that's been strategically shaved. Well, this is clearly because of his dynamic mixing technique, and he's just got such a way with the lady customers. No! He's there to chuck people out, and he doesn't. Instead, he takes abuse. He walks outside, and then he uses his superpowers to destroy this person's life. Because if you wreck a trucker's truck, you have two options: either that trucker owns that truck, in which case, congratulations, you've destroyed an investment roughly on par with their house. Like you contact the insurance agency saying, "Yeah, I had a accident." Okay, cool. Because your truck is worth basically $250,000 to us, we're going to go over there and we're going to see the accident. We're going to make damn sure what happened.
Yeah, sure. Whatever, man.
Crucified, you say? Someone crucified your truck. Yeah, we're not paying you your insurance there. The other side of this is that he might work for a company. In which case, from the company's perspective, you got drunk and somehow catastrophically ruined our truck. You're fired and you're probably on the hook for the truck.
Oh, also, you're going to have a hard time getting another job because if you're smart, you don't tell them to call us at the next place, and which means you spend most of your life without a job, right? You've been unemployed for 5 years.
Yeah, so also no health insurance. And this is all. And the thing is, if you tell this to the story, it's like, yeah, but he grabbed that waitress's butt and he poured water. He poured beer on Clark. Like, okay, I am not defending at all the grabbing of the waitress's butt. That is a wrong act. He should not do that. But the retribution visited upon him completely out of the blue, with no moral connecting tissue, with nothing to indicate to the man, this is because you grabbed that waitress's butt and threw that beer. Like, it's just the universe has decided to shit in this man's hat, right? And this is the general moral outlook of that universe. Terrible things happening to people at random but it's okay because Superman, who at this point is just the whitest, is totally in charge, and he's making these moral decisions. And this is the example they give of showing you that he is capable of making complex moral decisions for the best way. This is meant to be one of those moments where Clark's finding out who he is and what really matters to him, right? In a lot of ways, their version of Superman is a science monster that they don't realize is a science monster.
No,
I am so mad about Man of Steel.
Everybody seems to be mad about Man of Steel, dude. You are in good company.
Yeah. I am not ashamed of how angry I am about Man of Steel. Like, Batman v Superman was boring and bad, but it wasn't as grotesquely morally confused as the simple morality tale being told by a complete tool bag.
I think the other trigger that is like, you know, we look at the Thing, you know, who totally belongs in the Avengers, lifelong member of the Avengers. And how he sort of plays with that. Because he's in that same place as, like, Beast, where they're both science monsters. And, like, there's a thing people forget. Like, Beast made himself the way he is, right? Because, like,
before, the Thing, he was just kind of
a big dude. Now he, you know, after his own intentional self-alteration, he becomes a freaky monster dude. And...
Yeah.
Right. I don't know, I think there's probably a really good lesson in Ben Grimm's situation where it's like, don't trust your dumbass friend who thinks he's the smartest guy in the world. You will get fucked up.
Again, the morality tale of do not try and change what you are or who you are.
You know, if he had been like, hey, Reed, maybe we don't go into space this week. Maybe, no, we have to go. Okay, fine. And off they go. And fucked up he gets. Like, he gets the worst of it. There's no denying that. When you compare it to Beast, like, because even, it's funny how Thing, like, is still, I can understand why Thing is very sad about his personal situation. It's odd when they treat him as being socially ostracized, because, like, the Thing and Beast seem to be pretty, like, doing all right in their society, right? Like, obviously Beast has been on the Avengers, he's apparently had, like, a pretty active, like, love life and what have you, so has the Thing, and the Thing is also, like, a member of the premier supergroup in his universe, like, he's basically a celebrity.
Yeah. Well, the Fantastic Four at core are this whole concept applied in a really robust, very, very, very strong structure where every single character has a contrasting point and their scientific element contrasts with their personality.
Yeah, it's also pretty layered in that way because, you know, you have Reed who is he is the scientist, right? You have Ben, who is the science monster. Then you have Sue and Johnny, who are kind of, like, caught between the two of those poles there and their interaction with that. And, you know, it's Johnny who's like, oh, man, this all the science stuff's great. Awesome. And you have Sue who's like, yeah, okay, whatever, I guess. What does it get me, right? Like, a lot of her interaction is with, all right, well, how does that apply to me? Like, you know, Reed can be sitting there talking about all kinds of science shit. Like, yeah, all right. What does that mean for me, right? Oh, does it mean you're not going to be here taking care of the kid again, Reed? Is that what it means? All right, well, fuck.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to paraphrase Movie Bob, like, this isn't a summary I saw myself. Reed Richards is an incredibly stiff, inflexible man whose powers make him incredibly flexible and stretchy. Sue is a beautiful, prominent woman who likes fashion, and her thing is to hide. Johnny Storm is given an enormously flexible, versatile power, and he's a dumb kid, and Thing is raw emotions and big feelings turned into someone who can't express that very well, whose power is being a rock, basically.
And that's the whole like sci-fi concept as metaphor, right? And it works real well on that small level, right? Where it's just your personality juxtaposed against your powers. It gets a bit weirder when you go in that place of the Grand Socialist and, like, Isaiah Bradley. Like, he represents, you know, the government's terrible experiment on some people, but, like, these dudes volunteered and more or less knew what would happen, if my memory is correct on that story, right? Like, it's not the same as the Tuskegee experiment where people didn't even know. People were told they were getting cures for something that they weren't just to see what would happen. Like, they were said, oh, we're gonna give you this vaccine for syphilis, and they just pumped them full of water. And they're like, all right, and we'll what? Whereas in Red, White, and Black, it was, hey, we're gonna make you just like Captain America. Oh, okay. Oh, it doesn't work. Well, I mean, we told you we were gonna put drugs in you, and then we covered it up. Because, like, that's the real aspect of that story, whereas this horrible thing the government did in the interest of quote-unquote science was covered up, more so than how it was, specifics of it. It was just that fact, right?
Yeah, and indeed, that ties into part of the part of the thing with science as a threat that makes it very different from magic. Magic's whole thing, we know magic doesn't really exist. You know,
I wasn't gonna argue.
Sort of. Like there are some people who don't agree. Yeah. One of whom writes comics. A couple of whom write comics, actually. But the point is, the concept is, it's okay if we don't know how magic works, but science needs to have at least some connection with how we know the world works. This is why you might notice that so many of these things are lab accidents, because if it was a lab deliberate or a lab intentional, we'd have lots of them. We'd replicate the process. And this is what happened in a recent X-23 story. I guess just a Wolverine story, sorry. But the character, Laura Kinney, finds a whole bunch of test tubes with Venom symbiotes, I think it is, in it. Because it's a replicable process. They've duplicated the thing.
I mean, that gets into the whole idea of not being special anymore, right? And then you get out of the superhero genre. One starts giving it to everyone. And so you have the idea that we give, super science to everyone, and suddenly it stops being super science, right? Now it's just science in a world where science is different. And then that basically makes it magic, right?
Yeah.
It's not based on Mabel's, and it rules the universe. We just made a magical world. And, I don't know, because this is the thing of, again, expanding the science concepts, where you can have a character who used to be an accident, used to be a creation, and slowly over the time, via retcons, they become something else entirely, right? Not just in the sense from science to magic, just from, like, accident to intent, right? It depends, right? Take, like, the first movie version of the Hulk, right? Where, classically, it was the Hulk, you know, got caught in the explosion and became the Hulk. And now it's, he was intentionally experimented on by his father, who was always around him, even up to the, you know, final quote-unquote accident, and made him the way he was.
I mean, it sounds to me like you're quietly circling, just slowly around and around and around, mentioning Swamp Thing.
No, man. Because, here's the thing, right? We can go to Swamp Thing, or we can go to Man Thing, right? We can talk about things.
Swamp Thing, Man Thing. There's a lot of things going on here.
It's weird. So it's just flopping all over the place. But no, like, if the science becomes too common, I mean, that's part of why, I guess, how the threats become, like, we start dealing with new threats as those threats become more common knowledge in our world, right? We're like, we all just kind of accept the new threat, well, that's just the world we live in, sort of thing. And so we move on to the next thing everybody knows about, but not everybody understands. So it's, you know, it's GMOs, it's, you know, chemical testing, it's this, that, and third, becomes the new big threat. And if it reaches that same level of commonality in comics, it kind of ruins a lot of the purpose, right? I don't know, in my opinion. Because then it's not, there's a certain level of, like, fear and horror in it. And if it's happening every day, it's not scary. It's not unsettling if it's just part of the reality. It doesn't have that same impact. That's not always true, because, you know, there's the whole thing of, like, a clown's not scary in the circus. Oh, it's not scary in the circus, it's scary at dinner time, right?
Look, I'm just gonna go out on a limb here and suggest that there are some people who find clowns scary all the time, even at the circus. I mean, this isn't phylogenetic cladistics. There's no hard lines on any of this stuff. It's all a series of genre tag clouds. It's entirely possible to be a magically crafted science monster. In a lot of cases, the fact that he's magical actually gives him that edge on that front, because it means that he's able to say, look, I'm not going to talk about this in terms of a science problem. I'm not going to quote statistics or math at you. I'm going to talk to you in terms of human feelings. And if the rage of nature at what we are doing to it could be incarnated as a person, it would look like a very angry Lorax.
Yeah, and that's that was crafted quite a long time ago, and we're still dealing with the thing Swamp Thing was pissed off about. You know, Swamp Thing couldn't do it. What can we do? Swamp Thing couldn't save the world. That's some fucking shit. The fact that Swamp Thing is still relevant. That Swamp Thing's story is still relevant.
Yeah. Well, like, the story's about storing of nuclear waste. Yeah, that's,
yeah. Flint, Michigan hasn't had water since 2014. Your daily reminder.
Fuck.
10 years from now, someone's gonna, like, 5 years from now, someone's, you know what, fuck it. I'm like 50% sure Nick Spencer wrote that in some Captain America story.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, probably. Yeah. Like, that, yeah. And that, by the way, is another element with the science monster. In that you can tell the science monsters that are tapping into something the author doesn't necessarily know, but is still, like, part of the culture around them, so they reflect it. This is why, you know, Spider-Man's story is all about these connections to power and responsibility, but every time they've wanted to go into Spider-Man's backstory and say, something scary changed him that's got a spider attached to it, you'll note they always went to the science angle, or when they refreshed it, they didn't change the science angle. So that's the kind of general, you know, cultural overtone of it. Then you get the authors who are definitely making a point. One of the like, obviously Swamp Thing is a great example of that. Swamp Thing is absolutely 10,000% Alan Moore wants to make a point about this. You can also, he's not a monster, but you can look to Animal Man for the same thing, where the author has a very clear view on the science and wants to use it. And then you get these really performative things where they don't really understand the science they're working with, and they don't think understanding the science they're working with is meaningful. And that's where you get a whole host of these characters who mention science, but don't have anything to do with science. They don't meaningfully connect to science. And their cousins show up in the form of your Nick Spencer moments, of these aggressively performative, please stop hating me kind of gestures, where, I don't know, Hydra Cap at some point is shown saying, you know, Flint, Michigan is without water, went without water for this long because of your people. How do we trust you to make these decisions? Kind of bullshit. Or, you know, killing off Black Widow to try and invigorate a man's story because that's not one of the baseline comic tropes that we hold up to point out that comics is shit with women.
Thing is apical, really. Even the science stories are referencing, like, sort of political perspective of the person writing it, right? It's...
Yeah, yeah. All art is political. It's all being made by people.
When have we... I don't think if we've ever heard, a superhero story where it's like, yeah, sure, nukes, blow it all the fuck up. Not... Because we have plenty of stories about kill them all, blow them up with bombs. But do we have any that are super pro-nuclear destruction?
Very, very few.
You say few. That implies some. You got some? Because I'm... Because that's a thought, right? Because that's something we've never... I don't think we need or should want, but seeing them, I guess, can give us a vision of that outlook. Because I feel like I've seen people do that. Like, you know, fuck, we can see that now. Like, you know, fuck it, nuke that country over there. Do you understand the weight of nuclear destruction for you to say that? No, you know, but they don't care, right? It's a non-specific destruction thing to them.
Yeah, there's a picture you can find. There's a picture you can find floating around if you Google it, which usually gets captioned with something like the America Sea, which is the entire Middle East replaced with a gigantic crater that connects the Indian Ocean to the Mediterranean. And that's something people are swapping around going, well, you know, this would fix our problems if we just literally nuke the entirety of a region into a crater.
Like, those people aren't thinking of that, right? They're thinking, oh, this will bomb the entire area and turn it into a nuclear wasteland, and also the water will be poisoned, and also all the fish will be radioactive, and those fish are... None of that shit goes to their mind. They're just like, kill them. They just know, like, nuclear bombs are a good way to kill things. They don't think of it in any kind of greater concept. And they shouldn't even be wanting to kill those people in those places, but they've clearly gone past that conversation. We can't even say, hey, maybe don't kill them anymore. They're gone. You know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They're talking about, what is it? Precision carpet bombing. Which, by the way, this again, that performative science, like, people are aware that there is this thing called carpet bombing, and they're aware that the technology used in American military is very high tech, so they've got a vague understanding of what that means. But you could use a phrase like precision carpet bombing, and anyone who knows anything about carpet bombing, or indeed military precision, looks at you like you just grew an extra head.
And no extra brains.
Yeah. One of the other things with the difference between tech and science, especially as it applies to science monsters, is, and this is just a vague one, but tech characters tend to be dry, science characters tend to be moist.
go on?
Okay, so think about Tony Stark with his very fancy plane.
Yes.
All right? If that thing gets wet, the water sheets off it. That's fine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, despite the fact that it is a complicated piece of hardware and usually getting computers and stuff wet is a bad thing, the story doesn't really care about whether or not the suit gets wet. Whereas when you start dealing with the science characters, you are inevitably going to deal with fluids of some variety. You've got poison ivy, poison and spit. You've got the fact that Clayface basically is fluid. You've got, you know, acid sprays and...
Sandman is the definition. He is dry. He is dryness incarnate.
That is true, though he moves like a fluid.
But I continue. Continue with this gross metaphor you're going for.
just think about the signifiers of a science character. You've got this fluid in a beaker. You've got syringes full of glowing ooze. You've got glowing ooze. All the stuff that makes science-iness happen tends to be wet. It tends to be messy and it tends to be...
organic.
Yeah, organic. Whereas tech characters almost overwhelmingly are things that you can pull apart and put in a box. Even the cyborgs have, like, joints that you can, like, pull off.
Yeah, but here's the thing, though. Would you not consider, like, Ultron or Amazo to be science monsters?
Yeah, I could definitely see them as science monsters. Yes, you are right there.
Like, even if you go to, like, the Justice League animated version of Amazo, which is the real character, that whole thing of science creating a new life form, basically, and that life form being, you know, influenced by negative people. You know, the doctor makes Amazo, and it wakes up in a lab, and Lex Luthor just happens to be coming through to check on him. Like, hey, did you make that robot? Like, oh, you're a big thing, aren't you? Come with me. We'll talk. And, you know, the sort of infinitely, horrifically growing power of Amazo over the course of those two episodes, as, you know, Lex Luthor pushes him to fight Justice League, and, you know, how that story ends where Batman says, hey, copy Martian Manhunter's powers. Go ahead. They're like, the fuck? I'm like, do it. He can read minds. Okay. And look at Lex Luthor. And boom. It's over now. Like, he knows everything. He can sense everything, you know, all the lies and the manipulation. And so he just fucks off to space, you know? He's like, wow, people are terrible, right? And like, once you get to read minds, you're just fucking done with people entirely. And he fucks off to space. And there's just this quiet moment of, like, I really hope he never comes back. because he's going out into the universe and just copying everything. And, you know, eventually he does come back, and it's the worst thing ever. It's the biggest, most terrible thing that's ever happened. He destroys Oa on his way to Earth.
And that, by the way, that right there is an example of that magic science dichotomy where that character was very much doing the magic thing of a human interpretation of that, of applying a human reaction to statistical representations of facts. Because, of course, having a human look at a bunch of paperwork and go, wow, we're terrible, is we don't think, oh, that's a human interpreter, that guy could be wrong. And, you know, that guy doesn't have a special rightness to him in the story. When you direct a character whose whole thing is like, I'm a super brain, I'm smarter than everything, and then you show them going, wow, humans suck, it's like, you know, this is meant to be a reasonable judgment of humanity.
Right. Or you can look at Brainiac, and it's like that again, that sort of almost cosmic core that he represents of, you know, a machine that has no fucks to give about you, and that's the fear of the machine we're going to create eventually that destroys us all. That this is our future right there, and it's going to come back now and kill us. And how do you interact with that? How do you deal with that? Is kind of horrifying in its own way. And I mean, that's a lot of what, like, tech monsters end up being almost universally, just right? Or it's like the machines in the Matrix. It's just robots realizing that we have it coming and just blowing us up. Compared to, I guess, in that level, it's like that fear of the singularity that represents, like, machine horror is different from fear of human evil that represents, like you said, like, organic horror. Like, when you make the Hulk, the fear isn't just, you know, the immense power of Hulk, it's that it's controlled by a human, and humans get pissed off and do things, terrible things, you know?
Yeah.
Or that's what kind of makes, something used to be horror, and he became a hero almost from his, like, detachment from humanity, right? Because now he is, like, sort of, like you said, sort of, like, objectively right, because he represents a fundamental force of the universe. So we assume he's going to do the right thing, but a lot of times he will just, like, eat your city and plants. And it's almost like the thing you said about Darkseid, where, like, the real terrible truth of it is that he's right, you know? That fear. It's one thing to be afraid. It's one thing to have God basically come down and say, no, yeah, fuck you. It's time to get blown up. Because they almost take the hope out of the whole thing. I'll fight him. Maybe it's better that I don't fight. Maybe it's better that I just take it. It's sort of go sideways to that. It's the whole thing of, like, Godzilla or a lot of the, like, Osu monsters they stake. They used to be really big, you know, science fiction monsters. Basically just one guy sitting in a room drawing something, and the other guy would look in and, like, make a noise, and that would be the name of the thing. And that would just be like, oh, what's that? Gorgo. Okay, that's a story. And there was a billion one of those. Back then.
Why did you have to cite the one British one?
Tell me, I didn't know that was a real thing. I literally just said the thing I was just doing.
Okay, so just some bonus horror science content here. During the post-40s and 50s Godzilla craze, as Japan and Toei were churning out these movies, American studios started doing their own things, trying to do, like, King Kong and Giant Frankenstein movies, and they weren't so bad. But a Irish-British production attempted to make their own giant horror monster movie called Gorgo. Gorgo got made into an episode of MST3K. It is dizzyingly bad. And everyone has really, really thick accents, to the point where at one point when the monster first breaks free, someone in the commentary booth on MST3K shouts out, "McRoar or growl!"
The thing about this is, like, what I just said is, like, the thing Stan Lee said he used to do. Like, this used to be my job, you know? That's what Groot was. Groot was one of those. So much thing. And then he was like, what is that called? Groot? And that was a character. And that was a whole fucking... That's a whole genre of writing that kind of got, like, harkened back to in that recent event, Monsters Unleashed.
Yeah.
Which, like, I think got kind of a hard time because it was just kind of like a storyline instead of an event, you know, as comics are events. But it was alright. It brought a lot of those back. It had a lot of the classic ones. It introduced a character, which I don't think anyone's writing anything with. A kid kaiju. That's the thing, right? Those characters have become, because of time, the passage of time, you have Godzilla, who used to represent, you know, the horror of nuclear destruction, going from monster to, like, an action story to, like, a superhero. And then, sort of, the last couple of years, we've seen him come back around to being, well, in Japan, to being a representation of the horror of nuclear destruction. Mm-hmm. It's weird how in America, like, the American version just kind of, like, it was a good movie, you know, a good monster movie, but it just kind of skidded on by that whole conversation about, hey, no, this is because you fucking blew up Japan, you know? It was an ancient dinosaur that was always there that, like, maybe ate radiation or some shit, but, like one of the cooler things about, I want to say, it wasn't Godzilla Final Wars. It was, I think, Godzilla... And it was one of the second to last, like, Godzilla monster fights where it got very mystical. And so now that instead of being just a nuclear monster, it was the literal spirits of all the destroyed Japanese coming up to destroy people for basically not caring as much. It's almost like Godzilla got mad at being a superhero. Like, excuse me, I'm a fucking metaphor for death. Stop laughing! And became, like, Spirit Godzilla. And I think Shin Gojira is also that.
Yeah.
Okay, so you probably know which movie I'm talking about.
Well, what... I mean, I... believe it or not, I did a unit on Godzilla at uni. Yeah. And like, the original 1948 movie? 54?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm such a good academic. I can't remember dates. But the original movie, like, there is actually a point where a scientist says, we don't know where Godzilla came from. Like, we think it might be this thing that happened, but we legit don't know. And the conclusion of that movie is a scientist unleashing another super weapon to stop Godzilla.
Yes, oxygen. Right.
And then killing himself to ensure that weapon is never used again. Like, there is a moral framework in that story of science can trump science, but you have to be able to stop. You have to be able to put it down. And that, like, informs the whole Godzilla oeuvre of storytelling. Just this idea that science is scary, but we need it. and we need to be able to say when we're done.
Like, ethical limit of, okay, no, but actually, chill the fuck out, man. Like, stop. Stop. You have to stop at a certain point. And, because it's interesting, I think, I haven't seen Shin Gojira yet, because I don't have the access to it, but the way I've heard it described is almost like a story about, like, infrastructural incompetence in the face of a natural disaster.
Yeah.
You know? That's the whole point of it right now. It's just about how...
About Katrina, you say?
Well, Shin Gojira, the Japanese, the most recent Japanese one, is probably more about the earthquake and the nuclear
explosion. Yeah, Fukushima, yeah.
Fukushima, more so than that, you know? Because, you know, that's... You're going to talk about Katrina-level shit. That's... Again, that's another Swamp Thing story, right? It's about the negative impact we've had on our culture.
By the way, I just want to show another point of contrasting relationships to science, like different cultural zeitgeists. Fukushima was a nuclear power plant built on a fault line and a coastline in a culture, with slide rules. When Fukushima was built, the tech that they had to build it with was ridiculously low tech compared to now, right? And yet, they still had emergency procedures. They still had double checks and triple checks, and everything was designed to the point where if something went wrong, they had backups and fail safes. And when Fukushima was all shaken out, yes, huge amount of damage, very terrible thing. But it took a tidal wave and an earthquake and a system failure for anything of that scale to happen. And yet the culture is still sitting around going, holy shit, how did we not do a better job of this? Whereas in another country that's maybe a little less science-oriented and a little more inclined to really stupid ideas, you have a natural disaster, wipe a city off the map, and everyone sits around going, oh, well, yeah, nothing you could have done. Whoopsie. Well, sorry about all the dead black people. Look, I guess if we call them looters, it's okay.
We won't even do that about a motherfucker with a gun. You think we're going to do that about...
Yeah. Sorry for bringing things real down there. I'm just really salty about this stuff.
Yo, when we talk about Godzilla, the new Godzilla, right? The American one. The good American one. Good. Part of it was they show Bryan Cranston, like, working. And I guess it's kind of Fukushima-y in that way, where they show him working in a power plant in Japan, right? And it opens with the horror of it basically failing and the things that they have to do. And the reason it was failing is because one of these ancient... pre-Earth nuclear beings was just kind of thumping around under it because it got attracted to the radiation, right? Like, again, as opposed to the original story of the U.S. fucking launched a bunch of bombs at us and it mutated a lizard, right? That takes away...
Well, it woke up a thing. It woke up a thing under the ground. That was the other thing. That's an established part of Godzilla lore.
Yeah, but the thing is, this is a Japanese nuclear plant that this man was working at. So basically he's saying, oh, they brought it on themselves, as opposed to, we did this to them, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And that's...
Yeah. I see what you mean, yeah.
Yeah. And, again, that's that weird... And you take that to, like, the Hulk, right? We don't talk about... I mean, the Hulk still get radiation. They won't let that... They won't... Because they kind of made a fictionalized version of what gamma radiation is, they can still do that. But if memory serves... Like, in current incarnations, it's not a bomb anymore. It wasn't, hey, maybe not so much with the nuclear bombs. It's just, oh, he did a science thing, and it released gamma radiation. Like, originally, it was a bomb. We're making a gamma bomb, we're gonna test it, and, you know, the whole thing was, someone was gonna get into the middle of it. Again, we have your sort of ethical scientist. It's like, well, I gotta make a bomb, but it's out here in the middle of nowhere. Oh, shit, there's somebody about to be hurt. I better go stop it, and he gets, you know, the brunt of the force. He gets Rick Jones out of there, and he gets exposed to it. An idea of a scientist who knows, on at least some level, that there's something bad about what he's doing, and it has to stop at a certain point. I'm trying to remember what the current... I don't know if what the current, like, situation with Classic Hulk is, you know? Like, what's Mark Ruffalo's story? Like, because we know... That's the other thing, right? We know Amadeus Cho's story. He got the gamma radiation from the first Hulk, so now we've sort of cleaned... that story up where it's not about, you know, military oversight and scientific, you know, unethical science anymore. It's just, you know, science thing happened. Ooh. Because if we're still going by the narrative that the Edward Norton Hulk is same as a Mark Ruffalo Hulk, then that story just is he, best as we can tell, he did a science thing and he got in the middle of it. We don't know if he was creating a bomb. We don't have any about the ethics of that story. right? Because that's part of what was supposed to make the Hulk a sad, like a tragic figure, was that, yeah, he's working on a bomb, but look, he's saving somebody. Clearly, he's a good person, and he doesn't destroy this suffering that he has. I'm not, like, can you feel the same way about a guy who just was, you know, doing shit he shouldn't have done? That's how we put Dr. Octopus in that position, where he was just, from my understanding, the whole thing was he decided to do it himself, even despite of all, you know, evidence to the contrary. They're like, hey, maybe stop. And it's like, nah, fuck you, I'm gonna do it anyway, and blew himself up. All right, well, that's your fault. You get to be a villain, right?
Yeah, it recontextualizes it.
Whereas, again, Hulk, you know, Bruce Banner was like, ah, okay, I guess, his job. Oh, fuck, I better go see, you know, that puts the onus of responsibility on the system, which then goes back to attack him, again, to sort of cover up their own fuck-up. And...
Yeah. This is something you'll see a lot in comic book and superhero storytelling, the idea of the onus of power. Much in the same way in that first episode we discussed the idea that we know that that constantly having power is morally bad, that we recognize there is some reason to want to put it down, to reframe yourself morally. Almost all the science monster characters are characters, if they're good, it's because their science monster status was imposed on them. They did not pursue this power. And if they are evil, it is almost always because they pursued science at the expense of humanity.
I mean, it's why Sandman can go back and forth, right? He could be a good guy or a bad guy. Because, yeah, he was a criminal, he was blue-collar thug, but at the same time, shit just happened to him. So, you know, maybe he's not all bad. Yeah. Maybe he can be redeemed. So, I mean, that's kind of a thing they're doing with Clayface right now, where, you know, I don't know, because it depends on which version. I mean, I think they're still doing Basil Carlo, and the specifics of my memory of Basil Carlo are real fuzzy, especially comics Basil. Because my understanding of comics Basil was sort of heavily influenced by the cartoon, where, you know, if memory serves, he was an actor, and then his face got messed up, and so then he put the science stuff on his face, and that took him down that road, right? So that's kind of not his fault, especially as they've, you know, sort of to establish that the science stuff on his face also fucked with his mind. So a lot of the outright villainous things he's done since becoming Clayface aren't entirely his fault, you know? Like, he's got Clayface brain, and that makes him do bad things. So, I don't know how that plays. I don't think you've ever seen The Batman, the animated series that came right after the first Batman cartoon, the one everybody loves. It was made... The one everybody loves, and then there's the one everybody hates, which I think gets kind of an unfair shake sometimes. It was made by the same studio that did the Jackie Chan cartoon, right? And it's obvious, right? There's a lot of sometimes entirely unnecessarily kung fu fighting going on between characters like Batman and the Riddler, Batman and the Joker, Batman and the Penguin, who got a little something from the Orient, as he says. But one of the things that I feel like nobody will ever come for them on is their version of Clayface, because it's kind of a mixture of like the sort of plot line of the Killing Joke as it applies to Gordon and Clayface, where there's this black cop friend that Batman has that gets captured by the Joker, and who basically just, you know, tries to do the Killing Joke with him, but he doesn't have a daughter or a wife, so he's just basically torturing him off screen, and then when we flash back, he's just giving speeches, you know? And then some stuff gets splashed in his face, and he slowly becomes Clayface. And that plot goes back and forth over the next season or two of him going back and forth between villain and hero. Because he was a heroic character throughout the entire first season, and then this horrible science thing happens to him, and he becomes a monster. And then later they introduced another Clayface, who's basically the one we know, the actor who wants to do all the roles, and he's just a dick. And they fight, and they're destroyed, and that's sort of the final redemptive act of Ethan, the cop, where he, you know, redeems himself by destroying shitty dick Clayface. It's a lot better than people give it credit for, but it also deserves a lot of the shit it gets. So I can't defend it as much as I would be.
So this is what we're going to be doing for the month of October. We're going to talk a bit more directly about spooky stuff. So, with that in mind, that was Clay.
And that was... What? That was... That was Talon, and I may be being haunted right now.
I'm the guilt over not calling your parents enough, even though you know you shouldn't.
I'm global warming. You're all fucked.
I gotta say, coming out of fundamentalism fucking sucks, because you go, woohoo, ooh, I don't have to believe in the tribulation anymore. And then a scientist goes, so about global warming, you're like, fuck.
Oh my god, Talon, do you know how long I spent thinking that the fucking sky was gonna roll back when I was 17?
I know!
I was good for like 5 years.
I sat like, there in the car, like, yeah, looking out the window, waiting for the stars to go out in in the year 2000. Like, we were driving at midnight, and I'm just like, okay, any second now. Anyway, that's this week of the Science Monster. Tune in next time when we'll be talking about Blade.
Yeah, actually, for real this time.
Yeah, we probably will.